So welcome back, everybody, to the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, which is our new mini-series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and I am joined by my co-host today, Dr. Sean Cohen. Tonight's episode, we are super stoked to talk to you guys about cannabis use disorders with the incredible Dr. Deepika Slawik. But before we get too deep into that, Sean, will you please tell the audience what we do on this show?
I would love to, Carolyn. We are the internal medicine podcast for all things addiction medicine. We get to do expert interviews with some awesome people, people that we love learning from and look up to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge to all clinicians caring for individuals with substance use disorders, which is essentially all clinicians. And as a reminder, that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account.
And we want to give a very special thanks to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, who have partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction medicine faculty and trainees, and they are committed to supporting and training the next generation of academic addiction medicine leaders. Whether you're an addiction med physician preparing for the ABPM board exam or a physician in practice looking to learn more about the field of addiction medicine, ACAM offers several study products that would help meet your needs. Their professional practice bundle includes access to up to 86 self-assessment models that provide CME, as well as 46 didactic lecture recordings. And ACAM's board prep also offers access to the 46 didactic lecture recordings, along with nearly 200 item question bank and its addiction e-practice test. So make sure to check out their website at acam.org to learn more about membership and other products that they offer.
And I'll say some of those, I've listened to a bunch of those didactics and watched them, and they are all pretty good and very helpful for learning. But back to our show, we have this episode is a high point in our podcast with our guest, Dr. Deepika Slawik. She is an internist and infectious disease specialist, and she works in the field of addiction medicine. She practices at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx and is the co-director of the Montefiore Medical Cannabis Program. And she is awesome. She's a physician researcher. She studies how medical cannabis affects pain in people who live with HIV and the recipient of a K23 Career Development Award from NIDA. She is an amazing guest, and this is a killer episode. And I have to tell you what she teaches us. So she teaches us that being open and honest with your patients, really about everything, but particularly when talking about their substance use and cannabis use, really earns their trust and gets you really far. That cannabis use disorder does exist. There are treatments for both cannabis withdrawal and for cannabis use disorder that are effective. And that, like any substance use disorder, harm reduction should be at the center of kind of how we help people and keep them safe, and is something that we should think about with cannabis use as well. So let's jump into our case.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Deepika, we are so excited to have you on the show today. So we would love for the audience to get to know you a little bit better. So do you mind telling us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Sure. So I am a 38-year-old internist and infectious diseases doctor and addiction medicine specialist. And I have a particular passion for cannabis and medical cannabis, as well as a real passion for my dog, who I will talk about endlessly if given the opportunity.
You have to give us a little bit more. Yeah. Tell us about your dog.
She's a Puerto Rican rescue. She's the most beautiful dog in the world. We got her in 2017, and she has the best ears you can possibly imagine. So happy to provide pictures.
I was about to say, I feel like we have to put a picture in the show notes now. I'm always interested in how people, because I feel like addiction med attracts people very different ways and everybody has kind of their own journey to it. But like, how did you wind up in addiction med? What drew you to it?
So it's interesting because, you know, before I went to medical school, I did a master's in public health, and it was in DC. And I took a class that talked about harm reduction. And I was like, what is this? This sounds so cool. And they're like, this is like in 2006. They're like, oh yeah, you know, you should talk to these people at Prevention Works and, you know, like check out what they do. And I emailed them and they were like, yeah, come hang out with us. And so I started volunteering with them. Like twice a week or something, I would go out in their mobile unit and do syringe exchange with them. And I thought it was like such a formative experience for me. I mean, this was like just, I still remember the patients I worked with. I still remember the person who like ran it, who was a person who used drugs and was in recovery. And I learned so much from that experience. And I left it thinking I wanted to do HIV prevention and HIV care, which I still really like doing. And I do with my present practice, but I didn't realize that like doing addiction medicine is like its own niche within that. So, you know, I came to this kind of after I finished ID fellowship and was like, I really want to do more addiction medicine, and found my mentor and made my way here. And now I'm at Monty, and you know, it's pretty awesome that I get to do this mix of things.
Folks who work within harm reduction are just some of the raddest people I have met sort of across the board. So a plug for anybody out there who's interested, definitely take a look for folks in your community who are doing this type of work.
Absolutely.
So why don't we just jump into a case to sort of help ground our conversation? We're really excited to talk today about cannabis use disorder. So Sean, why don't you kick off a case for us?
Yeah, thanks. So we are seeing Miss C, who is a 32-year-old woman. She has a history of anxiety, major depressive disorder, and presents to you for a yearly physical. And when she talks to you about her anxiety, she tells you that she really smokes cannabis every day to kind of help her feel calm. She feels like it really gives her that anti-anxiety properties. And so I'm always struck by like when someone mentions cannabis use, like how do you get dive a little bit more into the history, determine it's a use disorder? And like, I think the bigger thing or as big a thing is like, how do you actually quantify what they're using too?
Yeah, this is a great question. And this is a case that's so similar to things that you see in clinical practice all the time. So I would dive into this kind of because she's already opened the door for you, right? She's told you, this is what cannabis is doing for me. So you could take really two approaches. So you could take one approach in kind of centering this around her anxiety and say, this is really interesting. Like you're telling me that your anxiety is uncontrolled and you're managing it yourself with your cannabis. So how does your cannabis fit into this? How does it fit into your own personal management of your anxiety? How do you know to use it? And what do you expect from it when you do use it? And usually that'll get people kind of talking because I don't think that people really ask patients these questions that often. So in my experience, they'll start being like, oh, you know, like sometimes I could get like a physical feeling and then of anxiety. And then that'll lead me down like, oh, I should have a joint or I should have a blunt or whatever. And so that's your opportunity to start saying like, wait a minute. Can you tell me what that means to you? Because everybody I talk to, a joint is a different thing. And if I'm in New York City, a joint is one thing. And if I'm in Austin, Texas, a joint is a different thing. And so give me more details. Tell me more about this. So that's usually my first step. And sometimes patients are a little more closed off about it. They may have had some experiences with other physicians who are maybe pretty cannabis negative, which wouldn't be that surprising. It's not been that long that there's been kind of a more open feeling toward cannabis in our country. But if you're able to kind of tease it out of them, then from there, I might start asking them questions about, you know, so if you're telling me that you use this whenever you feel anxious, like how many days out of the week is that? And if you were to quantify for me out of the past 30 days, how many of those past 30 would you say that you use cannabis? And I get pretty detailed when I start talking to patients about their cannabis use. I usually will ask them, you know, so if you had to quantify for me, like how much do you buy at a time? And oftentimes they'll speak in terminology that I might not know. So they might tell me they buy $20 at a time. they might buy $10 at a time. And I'm like, well, I don't really know the market rates in the Bronx right now. So could you help me understand what that means to you? And it's a lot of asking questions and letting the patient teach you, which I think is a common theme from your prior episodes. So it's nice, you know, that you get to learn from your patients. And then from there, you know, you can start asking those other questions, like how it fits into your life and how it may have impacted other aspects of their lives too.
I love that approach because it's just a way, as you said at the start, to really open the door. Because if we're really asking questions with curiosity and this non-judgmental way, I find that it's so much easier to get the story from the patient and really understand sort of their needs and how I can help them truly and ultimately be safe and like meet their own goals.
Absolutely. And with this case, especially, it's like, wait a minute, your anxiety is poorly controlled. What are we doing with it? You know, like regardless of the cannabis use, maybe we need to do something with your anti-anxiety medications right now.
Yeah. I love those two points of like, one, like not forgetting the underlying reason why they might be using the substances, but like starting with the positive, people use substances for a reason, right? There are beneficial effects that they get from every substance that people uses, and like kind of centering that a little bit in the beginning, both because I think no one ever does, but it also like gains you a little trust and gains you a little bit of to kind of help you then have maybe the harder conversations about the negative impacts is really, I think, a good approach and really nice.
And following that up, I find it challenging, honestly, more challenging than other substances to assess for cannabis use disorder. So because a lot of times my patients will say, honestly, they'll tell me that's impossible. They'll say, I've had many patients tell me that it is impossible to develop a substance use disorder or a dependence to cannabis. So I'm curious on your approach to really, again, determine truly and thoughtfully, like, does this person have a cannabis use disorder?
So when patients tell me that, I tend to just kind of back up a bit and say, like, listen, I'm not really interested in other people right now. I'm interested in you and how this substance is impacting you. So let's talk about your relationship with cannabis and how that fits into your life. And have you had experiences where, you know, you have felt like you needed to cut down and could not? Have you had experiences where this has impacted your career or your school or your relationships with your family? And kind of talk those things out. Because when you do that, I find that you start getting at kind of the beginnings of motivational interviewing, kind of like you would with all other substances. And it makes me think a lot of how I was taught to approach tobacco use disorder and alcohol use disorder, you know, because when you start getting to know people that well in that great primary care way and being like, well, how does this impact your relationship with like your kids or your family? Then you start getting into those details where they might actually be able to realize like, oh, this might be a problem. And you might be introducing them to that idea while you're talking to them at that time.
I think it's like, it's nice that I feel like so often when I was like a med student or a resident, I would think of like, oh, like they have tobacco or they're smoking tobacco or smoking marijuana. Like I need to figure this out, this appointment right now. And like, the sense I get from you too is like with motivational interviewing is this happens over time. Like you may try to get some information one visit, but it really happens over like as you build a therapeutic relationship over multiple visits and multiple months or years and kind of, again, that trust is so important to build over this process.
Absolutely. And like, I think that it would be so nice if we can get this information through our patients quickly in a 15 to 30 minute appointment in which you're running late and have like two patients waiting for you. But the reality is that that's probably not what's going to happen. And so because of the structure of our healthcare system and everything else, you're most likely going to need a more longitudinal relationship with a patient in order to tease apart all of these aspects, unless you see them in a situation of crisis in which they're having like a health-related impact from their cannabis use.
We are very lucky that we are in a situation where our patient is extraordinarily forthcoming. So on further history, to fit in, you know, our 10 minutes primary care podcast visit, our patient discloses that she has been using daily and has a hard time not using. She's thought about stopping a few times, but whenever she tries, her anxiety just gets really, really severe, and she has trouble sleeping. Her use has caused quite a few arguments with her family, particularly her sister, as she has young children and just doesn't want them to be around it. And when you bring up, again, when you bring up possibly considering her use disorder, she says, it's just weed. It's not dangerous. Plus, it's illegal everywhere. You know, how can it possibly be a problem? So I'm just curious on what you would think about in terms of next steps in this conversation.
Yeah. So I think, again, like recentering this to the patient and her situation. So she has just told you that she tried quitting. Sounds like pretty abruptly, and it did not go so well, and that she's having all of these other social issues with her family that stem from her use of cannabis. And so, you know, I think that I would sort of reenter that question, that conversation, and say, you know, Missy, it sounds to me that you're having some trouble with this, right? And you know, maybe some of these issues are related to how your family perceive your cannabis use and cannabis in general. However, you felt strongly enough about it to try to stop using. And so what can we do to try to address this for you in a way that centers your health, you know? And I don't know if she would listen to me that first time I talked to her about it. But after a while, hopefully she starts trusting and thinking about it, and some of our conversation starts moving forward.
And as cannabis has become legal in many states across our country, I think it is important to say that there can be some risks associated with chronic cannabis use. So what comes to mind when you think about counseling a patient on some of the risks of chronic use?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in this situation, just to sort of bust the myth that cannabis can't cause a cannabis use disorder, I would probably just give her the numbers, right? So like 8 to 12% of people who use cannabis, and those are numbers from people who use it recreationally, develop a cannabis use disorder. And that those are real numbers. I mean, that's 8 out of 100 people. It's not small potatoes by any means. And I'm sure she has encountered other people who have cannabis use disorder in her life. So I would start off with that. And then this is where I start getting really nitty gritty with the way that they're using their cannabis, because it's also the entry into a harm reduction conversation, which is my favorite part of it. So this is where you start being like, tell me how you're using your cannabis. So is it always inhaled? And if you're using inhaled cannabis, how are you inhaling it? So are you inhaling it as smoked flower in a joint, or in a blunt, or in a pipe, or in a bong? There's a million different ways you could be doing this. Tell me more about how you're using it. And if they tell you that they are inhaling their cannabis, then you have to explain to them the risks of inhaled cannabis, and that is that they might have a chronic bronchitis in their future. And, you know, this is primarily because of inhaling like very hot smoke that's heated up, right, with like a flame, and that passes through your airways. So that is not great for their airways, and people get chronic cough. We don't know the full extent to all of this because our research around cannabis kind of sucks, but you know, it's a reality that we know this is documented. So then you start talking about, do you ever mix things into your cannabis? So what papers are you using? Are you using cigar papers? Because cigar papers are tobacco leaf and they have nicotine and tobacco in them. And are you putting tobacco leaf into your joints to create spliffs or whatever you want to call it? There's like a million different slang terms for it. If so, you're getting the added risk of using tobacco with that. So you start talking about those risks. Now, if you're just talking about beyond that, so real risks that have been documented around cannabis use have primarily centered around risks to mental health. So a lot of what we have heard about, and I think a lot of what we've learned about in medical school and residency in terms of risks of cannabis use, have centered around the risk of worsening anxiety for people who are using high doses of THC, which interestingly, she's suffering from anxiety right now. And then in people who are young, in those young adult years, there's a risk of cannabis use triggering like schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders that they might be predisposed to genetically. So those are the big major chronic risks of chronic use. Another less well-defined risk is cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, which I think a lot of us are really interested in, but it's really poorly defined. And up until recently was really defined primarily through case reports. So it was all case reports, and the definition of it really centers around someone who uses cannabis for at least a year and develops a cyclic vomiting syndrome. And it's not only just a year of use, it's a year of use frequently. So like 4 days out of the week. And they develop the cyclic vomiting syndrome that doesn't look the same in everybody, that kind of magically resolves when you stop using cannabis, but usually requires abstinence from cannabis use for about 6 months. So those are all risks that I would talk to her about.
Yeah, I like the starting with, I mean, especially with her saying like, oh, is there really a risk? Can I even develop a disorder because this is legal? Like starting with some, like a little bit of statistics just to ground it, but then getting into the like harm reduction, like here are risks, but here's how we mitigate them. I think I love that again as like a way to, I feel like it's like when you do things that people don't expect that can be helpful for them, it's kind of gains extra trust too. And I feel like it's so, at least in my experience, rare that people have like harm reduction counseling from a physician often, that it can actually gain a lot of trust too.
Yeah. My dream is that everybody would think about this as a spectrum, right? So like there's the ideal thing that like your perfect patient who doesn't exist would do. Like in my ideal world, you would just listen to me and do it. And then there's like all these other steps in between that they can take. And if they listen to anything that I tell them to improve their health, I would be thrilled. So like that makes our jobs feel easier. It makes the like hurdle much lower for the patient. And I think it creates more of a pathway for the patient to get to that point of improved health.
And take us through a little bit of that spectrum, since we're on the topic already of harm reduction. How do you counsel a patient again about less harmful ways to use cannabis?
So say Ms. C tells you like, I smoke a joint and I add like tobacco to it, probably like 3 times per week, hypothetically speaking. So you could say, okay, that's really interesting. How do you feel about the tobacco that you're adding to your cannabis? Why is that happening? So I always thought that was in order to change the way that the cannabis made them feel. Like I thought it was had something to do with like the high that they would get. More recently, when I've been asking patients, they've been telling me it's to bulk up their product because their cannabis is expensive. And so this was a way to like make it last longer. The things that you learn from asking patients. But so you could talk to her about, okay, so what if we maybe stopped putting tobacco in your cannabis and just sort of let the amount that you have be the amount that you have? That would be like a real baby step, but it would be a great step because she would be reducing her tobacco use. For anybody who's using combusted cannabis, I talk to them about using regulated vaporized cannabis as an alternative to combusted cannabis. So, you know, I really do think that having anything that will, so especially if it's vaporized and regulated, you're going to have a lower temperature. And the reason I say regulated is because in a lot of our states right now, we do have options for people to purchase recreational regulated vaporized products. I think it's in about 20 states in the US right now. So she could potentially have a safer option that is more similar to what she likes to use to manage her symptoms. Then beyond that, there are other routes of administration that are safer than inhaled for various reasons. You know, like you're not potentially causing damage to your airways and you're not adding things to it like tobacco, and you don't have as many risks of it being contaminated with other drugs or tar or pesticides or heavy metals. So beyond that, you can look into other regulated products such as tinctures or edibles that you could purchase from the regulated market. I realize that this is not a reality for the entire country, but it's how I would approach it here in New York State.
So I think, I mean, on the subject of keeping our patients safe and of harm reduction, I think, I mean, one of the things I think about a lot, I think, as an addiction medicine doctor is, like you said, is having a safe supply and how dangerous kind of the illicit market is for substances in general. And so for people that are using cannabis and may meet criteria for cannabis use disorder, it's particularly in states that are kind of have medical cannabis laws. Do you ever think about certifying them for medical cannabis so they have a safe supply? And I think kind of away from the medical risk too, I think the risk, the kind of the legal risk and criminal risk that disproportionately impacts minoritized communities, you think about kind of it from that perspective too.
Yeah, this is a really important question, and it's something that I've kind of struggled with throughout my time working in cannabis. So I got really into cannabis and managing cannabis use disorder and seeing people with cannabis use disorder, not necessarily through primary care, but because I started working in medical cannabis. And what I got really introduced to was people would be coming to me saying, you know, I just don't want to have to deal with the police anymore. Like, they're essentially harassing me. And I want this as a tool to help me. So it kind of brought me into thinking about this in a different way. And I think all of us probably went through a period of time of being trained to be kind of paternalistic in our medical training. You know, I think that that's how I was trained as a medical student. And I think that that was just the times. But it kind of brought me to this point of initially I had like stages of change. So I started off being like, oh, why are they even asking me about this? And like, this is crazy. This is like a legitimate thing that they should be using to treat a symptom. And then now I've kind of come full circle on it. So the thing is that unregulated cannabis has the potential for being contaminated with, we know, cocaine, synthetic cannabinoids like K2 and spice, which can cause crazy hallucinations for people and be dangerous and unexpected. It could also have tar, pesticides, heavy metals, and all sorts of other nasty stuff in it. And linking people to a safer version of cannabis does nothing but good for those people. So if a person comes to you and says, I'm going to use cannabis and I'm going to use it whether you tell me to or not, I believe, and my expert opinion is that they should have access to a safer version. So depending on the state that you're in, if you have only medical cannabis available to them, which is the situation that New York State is in right now, then the best way for you to do that is to certify them for medical cannabis. And the best thing about doing that is that you get to really be prescriptive about how you tell them to change over to medical cannabis. So you can say, here's what we're going to do. You are going to continue using cannabis because you want to continue using cannabis, but we're going to treat it like it's a substance that's treating a symptom for you. So we're going to switch you to, I'm going to encourage you to switch to a formulation of it that is much safer. And we're going to ultimately, our goal is to get you on a dose of THC that is potentially lower than what you're using right now to minimize your risk of mental health symptoms. And, you know, make sure that you're using something that is regulated by the state and we know is not going to have all of those additives in it. In terms of reducing risk of criminalization in our communities, you know, I don't really know that we know for sure that certifying people for medical cannabis actually does that. So I think in theory, it kind of does because it's kind of like getting a doctor's note, you know, like my patient needs cannabis for their medical issue. However, I mean, I've had patients here in the Bronx who still have gotten arrested for having cannabis, and we have decriminalized cannabis here. So, you know, this is like what I've learned through all of this is that a rule is only as good as the people who are enforcing it. And I think that culturally, we're still in a place where we want to punish people for using drugs. So I think the intent, if the intent is there, you might be able to help them a little bit with that aspect of it. But, you know, I think that as long as that's kind of the ethos around it is harm reduction and getting them safe supply, I think that that's an absolutely appropriate thing to do.
And I want to encourage our listeners to be familiar with their own state. laws and regulations, right? So there are different medical conditions that you can certify people for, different indications, et cetera. So I really encourage folks to sort of be familiar so they can counsel their own patients, counsel your own patients just accurately.
It's definitely worth noting that to our knowledge, there aren't any states at this time that actually allow medical cannabis certification for cannabis use disorder itself, but many people who use cannabis have other approvable indications. So certifying them for those reasons can allow them to access this safe, regulated supply.
I mean, so procon.org has like the entire country, right? You just Google like procon.org medical marijuana, and you can look up exactly what the bill says in your state and, you know, get a better sense for what you can potentially tell your patients. And then, of course, you guys had the great episode with Dr. Arnston on the regular Curbsiders podcast that goes more into medical cannabis.
Yeah, we'll plug that episode right now. So definitely be sure to check out on the original Curbsiders feed, episode number 338 live, Medical Cannabis. Is it still dope?
Also, amazing title, I think. Kind of stole my dad joke thunder a little bit, but I have to come up with something else.
This is a pretty good title too. So Sean, why don't you get us back into our case?
Yeah, that sounds good. Let me just find my place. Yeah. So on the first visit, like we've kind of thought she's gotten a lot of information and she's like, I'm going to think about this a little bit and I'll get back to you. And so a few months later, she comes back for a return visit. She again tried to kind of decrease her use and eventually stopped smoking, but her anxiety just kept ramping up and ramping up. So she felt like she couldn't actually stop or even reduce her use. And so I think, and this brings up the question of like, could this be cannabis withdrawal? What are the typical symptoms of cannabis withdrawal?
Yeah. So cannabis withdrawal can look kind of all sorts of different ways. So it could be increased anxiety, agitation, irritability, worsening insomnia. It could also be like decreased appetite and weight loss, which is kind of easy to remember because we think of cannabinoids sometimes being an appetite stimulant, right? So if you take it away, you'd have some weight loss or reduced appetite. Also going along with all of that, restlessness, and then people might have depressed mood. I've never necessarily seen some of these things, but I know the DSM-5 says that people can also get like shaking tremors and sweats and chills. I've never seen that clinically, but it is in the DSM-5 for the definition of cannabis withdrawal. So, you know, she may have had worsening anxiety, worsening insomnia and stuff when she reduced her dose of THC and CBD, when she reduced her cannabis use. And so for this, I mean, I hate to harp on this, but so many people do combine tobacco with their cannabis. So I often first think about nicotine replacement therapy to help them if they are now cutting out all the nicotine that they were using because they stopped using cannabis. So that is one thing that you can do to kind of like address that aspect of it and say, hopefully this will take the edge off and make you feel a little better. If Soma C has already previously diagnosed anxiety and depression, another thing you could do is just optimize her management of her anxiety and depression. And you might need to give her a short course of like something to help her with her anxiety. So whether that's benzodiazepines, which I know many of us are like, I don't want to give anybody benzodiazepines, but sometimes it's needed, you know, or other anxiolytics, that might be helpful for her. The other thing that you could do is just symptomatically treat her insomnia if that is a symptom that she's having. So things like Zolpidem or your other favorite insomnia treatment is another thing that you could do. I think the key is really symptomatic management. The other thing to consider is to talk to her about it, like go through it with her, how she's going to reduce her use, because it's very possible that she's reducing her use way too quickly. And when I say that, it makes it sound like there's a right way of doing it. I don't think that there is, but maybe she just needs to do it more slowly, you know? So you could talk to her about like, maybe don't go from like 4 joints today per day to 1 joint per day, because that's going to make you feel terrible.
In your practice, do you ever use gabapentin to help manage some of these symptoms?
I feel like we use gabapentin for everything right now.
Either gabapentin or topiramate, yeah.
Right. I have not really used gabapentin for this. And a lot of the reason for that is because oftentimes I'll see my patients and they'll just be like, I did it. And I'm like, what did you do? What happened? And they've already stopped their use. And they never told me about their symptoms of withdrawal that they were having, you know. So perhaps I could have headed that off by checking in with them more frequently while they were going through this and giving them their benzodiazepines or their zolpidem. You know, I don't have a lot of experience using gabapentin in this scenario to say that I feel like it would make a huge difference. Maybe it would. It seems like it's theoretical at best in terms of the evidence right now.
I've used it a couple times in practice. I think mostly for those anxiety symptoms that my patients are describing sort of at this top, like generally the first 1 to 2 weeks folks are telling me can be really tough. So sometimes I'll do gabapentin or the zolpidem for a couple of days because that rebound insomnia can be pretty intense. I've not had success. Most of my patients are like, yeah, I took this for 2 weeks and then I just sort of self-stopped it, you know, et cetera. But I have some folks say that it was helpful for that anxiety component. But some folks could say the benzodiazepines or the hydroxyzine, you know, as well could possibly be helpful as adjuncts.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, I think that that's something I have never been so comfortable with gabapentin as I was when I started doing outpatient withdrawal, like management of alcohol withdrawal in the outpatient setting. And once I started doing that, I was like, oh, we'll just use gabapentin for everything now, right? And like, what, like, why was I worried about 300 milligrams before? So, you know, I mean, I think that now I'm a little more comfortable with the idea of using it for symptoms like anxiety. And that might be a great thing to add to the toolkit for that.
And I think as you alluded to, it's when you catch the patient, you know, as busy primary care providers, we may be seeing patients every month. We're lucky if we see patients every month, quite honestly. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So it sounds like overall you think about essentially like most withdrawal syndromes is a lot of the symptoms of cannabis withdrawal are just the opposites of kind of cannabis intoxication. It's like that decreased appetite, trouble sleeping, increases anxiety, and most of the treatment is kind of based on each of those symptoms, not forgetting to kind of address, again, the underlying anxiety or the underlying cause of them kind of using cannabis too.
Right. And I think that that's a great way of also, as a side note, I think it's also a great way of making sure you keep the patient engaged with you in treatment, is that it's not like they came to you being like, I need help with my cannabis use disorder, at least not in this case. She came to us saying, my anxiety's out of control. So if we center this around the cannabis and the anxiety, then you're going to have a lot more buy-in from your patient.
And she decides that she does really want to stop cannabis. She's been started on an SSRI to help manage her anxiety disorder. And she's just curious because she's had so many struggles in the past in terms of trying to cut down her own. She wants to know if there are any other type of treatment options for her cannabis use disorder.
Yeah, so the gold standard is really, at this point, psychosocial interventions. So motivational enhancement treatment is one of those. And I think as a primary care provider, you would most likely be referring out to a therapist to be doing that. And that really works with the patient to sort of strengthen this way of thinking of like, how does the cannabis benefit me? How does it impact my life? And, you know, what do I do with that information? And how do I essentially get to a point of thinking about this in a healthier way? The other thing that has good evidence is cognitive behavioral therapy. Again, likely you would be referring out to a therapist for that. And then also contingency management, which I know has been researched quite well and has decent results. However, I've frankly never encountered it clinically. I think some people may have, but I have not. So that would be another option if it's available to you in your medical center.
I will say I think of the psychosocial interventions the same way. And I think fortunately we've worked in a clinic that has contingency management, and it's really cool. I think sometimes because it can gain people's trust because they're like, what, you're paying me to do things that are you think are good for me? But it's also, I think the barrier is it's hard to get funded often.
Yeah, that sounds so cool. I want to learn more about that. I would love to know how that is implemented in a clinic setting, because I've just read the studies essentially. But yeah, I can imagine it's hard to get funding for that. I guess one day maybe insurance will pay for it or something.
One can only dream.
We can dream.
Yes, exactly. Having lots of aspirational thoughts this evening.
Are there any meds? I know, like, I feel like I remember reading something about like NAC, but I think it was only in like adolescent patients. But are there any other medications, or is NAC good for adults too?
So NAC has been studied in adolescents and somewhat in adults as well. And it in adolescents was found to reduce cravings for cannabis use. And this was really limited to people under the age of 25. When these studies were repeated in people who were older, they didn't come up with the same results. So it really washed out. There was no big difference between placebo. So unfortunately, it didn't really have very many promising results. I do know kind of anecdotally that some physicians will be like, go pick up NAC from your supplement store and see if that helps. You know, I don't know if there's a huge risk to it, but also it feels like a little bit of an extra thing if it's not going to help that much. I think that there are other things that have been studied, but again, have kind of weak evidence at best. So like topiramate, and there has been some interesting thought about using other cannabinoids that are FDA approved, so like nabilone, or which is a combination of THC and CBD, and also dronabinol. So as far as I can tell, dronabinol showed no difference between itself and placebo when it was studied for this purpose. I would never choose to give dronabinol to a patient, you know, like as an alternative to plant-based cannabis, primarily just because it's unopposed synthetic THC and the side effect profile is just not great. I mean, I think the main reason it's not used that much is because people can't tolerate it. So interesting thought, but it doesn't seem like in the evidence it really panned out. So I think that's kind of where we are in terms of medication management of cannabis use disorder. And it's something that really needs to be studied better in terms of potential options that we could give to our patients. So they know that there are patients out there that want a pharmacologic option.
And I guess another plug to know your available resources, or try to like create some relationships with people that do some of these kind of psychosocial interventions like CBT or MET, and kind of have some people that hopefully you trust and can get patients to in your community and at your institutions too.
Yeah, I'm not aware of like things like virtual options and stuff for places who are in more rural areas that might not have as many resources. But I think I don't know if that would be something that would be a good option. I don't really know that it's been studied well. I think it might be a necessity, whether or not it's well studied at some point.
This has been an absolutely outstanding episode. We have loved having you. We want to be conscious of time. So I was wondering, could you give us a few take-home points for our listeners?
So I would say the take-home points would be that patients would like us to be open and honest with them, and they want to be open and honest with us if we're willing to listen to them. So, we need to be able to have these conversations with our patients and ask the questions and learn about what our patients are doing. It is possible to have cannabis use disorder, and there are treatments for it, and we should be offering it to our patients. And for everything in every aspect of medicine, harm reduction, harm reduction, harm reduction. I think it's the name of the game.
I love that. I always love the starting with the open and honest, like gain some trust, and you can go like a very long way towards helping people. Is there anything else like you want to plug, medical or non-medical, something that's like interested you recently or something?
Yeah. You know, one of my residents in clinic yesterday introduced me to this podcast named Crackdown. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it.
It's great.
But it is so good. I listened to like 4 episodes in the past 24 hours. I was like fascinated by it. I can't believe I didn't know about it before, but I think people should 150% listen to that. It's amazing. It's really, really well done.
Can you tell us and our listeners a little bit more about the premise of the podcast?
So my understanding is it's from the perspective of people who use drugs, and they talk about their experiences with treatment, with using drugs, with kind of society's response to using drugs. And so the episode I listened to, which is totally not, well, I guess it's peripherally related to our topic today, but she was talking about her experience getting started on treatment for opioid use disorder with Suboxone, and she really felt like it was pushed on her. And I wish I could remember the people's names who were in it, but so I don't just refer to people as him and her, but regardless, it was just very eye-opening as somebody who is an ex-wavered provider, you know, like, I hope I never do that to somebody. So
yeah, completely agree. I think I found Crackdown when I was like a hospitalist, and it really like honestly cemented me wanting to go into addiction medicine, because it was just like such an eye-opening experience. And then Ryan McNeil, who's I think like the science advisor for it, came to Yale right after, and I like completely fanboyed and was like, oh my god, he's coming here, like that's so cool.
It's a great podcast. Definitely check it out. This has been another episode of our Curbsiders miniseries, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
We are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we love and need your feedback, which we've gotten a little bit of so far. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts and contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. A special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams to support this project, as well as to ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, where you can learn more at acam.org.
And a reminder that this and most of our episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.bcohealth.org. All you have to do is make an account. And until next time, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan.
And I'm Dr. Sean Cohen. Thank you for joining us today. Let us bring you lots of pearls on cannabis use disorder and substance use disorders in general.